of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this October 16th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. And we are still inviting you to write in and give us your feedback. I got a couple of really great pieces of feedback this week. And so we really appreciate that. Tell us how we're doing. Tell us what you would like more of, like less of, format. Any comments that you have, if you are a longtime listener, we would love to hear. You can email Barbara at penonfire@earthlink.net. Again, penonfire@earthlink.net. You can always write to me at mariestone@gmail.com. Two R's in Marie. I am your host, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. I pre-recorded this interview with Elizabeth Strout last week. I'm going to try and play all of it. If it cuts off a bit early, the entirety of it will be up on air on our podcast, so check that out if we miss anything. In the second half, Lisa Funderburg will be here with her anthology. Elizabeth Strout is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Olive Kittredge, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, Anything is Possible, winner of the Story Prize, My Name is Lucy Barton, long-listed for the Man Booker Prize, The Burgess Boys, named for one of the best books of the year by the Washington Post and NPR, Abide With Me, and Amy and Isabel. She's also been a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction, the International Dublin Literary Award, and the Orange Prize. Her stories have been published in a number of magazines, including The New Yorker. Motherless Child, which is part of this collection, appeared this past summer in The New Yorker. And she was on the show with me both in 2016 and 2017 for Anything is Possible, and My Name is Lucy Barton. But we have never had the chance to talk about Olive, and we're going to get to do that twice, because on October 31st, Halloween, Elizabeth is coming to Laguna Beach, and we're going to talk in person. You can find information about that event on my websites under events. Olive, again, is the book. It is published by Random House, and it's driving our discussion this morning. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really nice to talk to you again.
I love it. I love it. So it was my love of Olive that led me to your other work. So she was sort of my gateway drug, I would say. I'm so happy to see her revisited. So it's interesting that the first time we met her was back in 2008 when the country
right.
was sort of in the middle of this generation's biggest financial crisis. And as right. we're revisiting her now, we're sort of in the middle of this generation's biggest, we could say, political crises.
Right.
And, you know, while that's not kind of explicit in Crosby, Maine, it's definitely rippling beneath it all.
Right. So, exactly.
Yeah. So I guess my first question is to what extent you think or you think about when you're working kind of the characters as commentary on the times, or if that's not really it, if they're just living through the times?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that when I write, I'm mostly focusing on making sure that the character is as emotionally truthful as I can make the character be. But the character, in order to be emotionally truthful, does live in a time and place in history. And so that has to come in and be a part of it, even if it seems very subtle to the reader. I am aware of where they are and what's going on in the world.
Yeah, yeah. And such a rich environment. I mean, I don't know if you saw coming, you know, a lot of people that spend time in some of these small towns, and Crosby, Maine strikes me as one of those towns, kind of saw this crisis coming in a way that people living in Manhattan or people living in California
right.
did not.
Right.
And, you know, I was just kind of curious, as you are such a unique observer of the world, and you're straddling both of those worlds, living in New York and living
right.
in Maine, and really having your finger on the pulse of mm-hmm. these people, of Olive, how much you kind of saw some of this stuff coming.
Well, you know, I think I did not see it really coming because I didn't want to. But once it came, I saw where it had come from.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense.
It does make sense. It does make sense.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about, and I have read kind of Olive coming to you while you were washing the dishes one day, but I'd love to hear the story again of just, she's such a force, and I just love to kind of hear how she introduced herself to you.
Right. Well, the first Olive Kittredge book, the very first time Olive showed up, I was unloading the dishwasher, and I could feel her behind me. It was like there was a real presence behind me, and I could hear her in her head saying to herself, "It's high time everyone left." And she was so forceful that I thought, "Oh, I've got to get this down." And that was the story about her son's wedding, which was in the original Olive Kittredge. That was the first story of that collection that I wrote. And then I thought she was done, you know. So years went by, and then I was in Europe, and I had a weekend alone, and I was at a cafe, and all of a sudden she just showed up again, only this time I actually saw her, like, nosing her car. I mean, I saw her, you know, visually nosing her car into the marina for breakfast, and I thought, oh, wow, I can't believe that you're back. So I had to write it down, and that was the first story in that book that I wrote, which is called The Poet. Mm-hmm. So,
is there another?
That's how she came to me.
Yeah, so great. Is there another character so vivid to you who speaks so clearly to you and through you as she has across any of your books?
You know, that's interesting because I feel closely connected to every character that I've written. Frankly, I feel a real connection to them, even when I'm done writing them. But Olive has. Her personality makes her different, you know. So she's probably a little bit more striking to me as her creator.
Yes.
Even.
And to us as readers. And you know, she has her own lexicon. I mean, she certainly has her own way of speaking and her own internal thoughts.
Right.
You know, she's just got this verbiage that's so uniquely her.
Right.
And I imagine that's really organic, but, you know, once she's out there, I wonder if you just write down all these verbs, like she would see people yakking or she'd, you know.
Right, exactly. And when I was writing the second book, I was a little bit nervous that I might not be able to find that voice for her again. But then I realized, no, she's Olive. She's helping me do this, you know. I could, you know. So I thought she still does have her pop.
Oh, she sure does. She sure does. Did the HBO miniseries with Frances McDormand playing her in, you know, there so often things make to screen after the book is out, but I'm trying to think, I guess The Handmaid's Tale might be another example of this, but where the screen happened and then the author goes back to revisit their own work, their own character, after this visual thing has kind of been inserted in everyone's mind. And I was wondering if that impacted anything, like if you had Frances McDormand now in your head. And the interesting thing, that the reason I asked that is because I did not. You know, when I went back to Olive, I thought, oh, now I'm going to have Frances McDormand rocking around in my brain. And I didn't.
Right.
And I was trying to figure out why. It was kind of weird.
Right. You know, it's interesting because, no, I didn't have Frances in my head the second time around. And I, you know, I sort of half noted that to myself. But and I think, you know, Frances did a wonderful job playing Olive Kittredge. But she didn't visually look like the Olive that I have in my head. And so when I went back to write about Olive, she still wasn't Frances because she never had been in my head.
Yeah.
I mean, visually.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Right, right. Yeah, I just thought it was kind of interesting to visit somebody after the fact, you know. I mean, we visit them before the fact, but yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Right, right.
I'm also curious about this this idea of, I imagine living in Manhattan has given you such a different perspective on small town Maine, where I know you also spend a lot of time. And I usually talk about to writers about writing place from a physical distance, but this is really writing a place from like a serious psychological and economic and political distance. And, you know, not just geography, but really mentality.
Right, right. And culturally. You're
and
exactly
culturally.
Right. Yeah.
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 And I'm curious about inhabiting, like, is it easier to do this from sitting in New York, or is it necessary to go back to Crosby's fiction, yeah, but back to Maine and spend time with these people psychologically? What's your relationship, right, with space?
I think that I had to live in New York for a long time before I was able to write about Maine. But that's many, many years ago now. And so I was aware of that as I grew as a writer. I realized, oh, I had been writing stories about New York before I could really absorb what New York was. And it wasn't until I was living in New York and thought back about Maine that I began to find my voice as a writer. So the separation for me to leave Maine for all those years was very important, because Maine is so much a part of me that it was really what I needed in order to be writing. And so since that time, I've come back and forth to Maine a lot more. And honestly, I can write either place, in New York or Maine. It doesn't seem to matter, because my head is so much, you know, in this particular book, it was just in Crosby, Maine, which is a fictional town, but I just felt like I knew it. So it didn't really matter where I was when I was writing it.
Yeah, that's so cool. I think it was James Baldwin that said something about secondary characters being kind of the drivers of the story, that we don't pay enough attention to our minor characters, and that they often hold sort of the secrets to what we're really trying to get at. And I don't know that I've ever read anything else that exemplifies that as much as these olive books do, you know, that the whole key to her, not even just the key to her, but just the key to the book really lies in the secondary characters.
Right. In the cleaning girl.
Yeah, the cleaning girl.
And, you know, Danny Pelletier, who takes his walk and, you know, had worked in the mills for so long. Yeah, this is all a part of the world that she lives in. And even if she doesn't fully know it and they don't fully know her, it's all one piece, you see.
Right. What does your office look like in terms of, like, do you have sort of a mental map, or actually a physical map of the town where all these people live, and character diagrams of how they cross each other?
No, it's very, I'm my studio is a total mess. I will tell you that. It's just messy. Because I really like mess, and because it's my studio and nobody else gets to go in there or needs to go in there, then I get to have it messy, which I just enjoy. So there's tons and tons of papers flying around, and it looks chaotic, and yet so oddly I seem to know where a certain piece of paper is when I need it, because I'll write in scenes, you know, different scenes, and they just float around that room, and then all of a sudden I'll realize, oh, this scene, right, where is it right now, that's where it will go. So it's a very strange thing as I think about it. So it's all in my head is what I'm saying, and also all around the floor and the table.
You know, as you're saying that, it's coming to me that not that that's how the book is obviously put together, but in the experience of reading the book, it reads obviously like short stories, which is what it is. And then in my memory of it, it reads like a novel. You know, I've asked so many people, oh, have you read Olive Kittredge? And they're like, oh, I love that novel. I'm like, well, it's not a novel. It's a collection of short stories. But accomplishing that trick of creating a collection of short stories that in your memory feels like a novel. And I don't even think it's just because they're interconnected. I think it's something else. And I just can't put my finger on what I think it is that makes this read more like a life or, you know, a just sort of generational.
Right. Well, there is, I mean, you know, we do follow, the book begins with Olive at one point and ends with her at quite a different point. So, I mean, there is that novelistic quality to it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, I sort of think of it as a novel, even though I know it's short stories and, but I don't really care if anybody calls it a novel or calls it short stories. It doesn't matter to me, but I understand why you feel that, you know, after you put it down, that it was a novel, because it does unfold her character a little bit more every time we have a different chapter or a different story.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part of the sense of why one feels that they're reading a novel.
I'm almost wondering if the key to that lays in your organization of your office, where you say it's, you know, it's chaotic and messy. However, I know where every single piece of paper is, and I know where it goes, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. It is. It's always interesting, and I notice it every time. Because there always comes a point where it's so messy and so chaotic that I sort of think, oh dear, but it's happened enough now that I just, can hold on and pull myself through it and get the different things to go together. But I think from an outsider's point of view, it would be strange looking.
So this collection, you said, started with The Poet, was the first book, with the first story that you wrote.
Right.
I was wondering if we could just go through one or two of these from the inception of, and the one that kept coming back to me was the Civil War, the end of the Civil War.
Oh, yeah.
Loved that story.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, so great. But I was wondering if we could take maybe one or two of these, maybe The Poet, maybe End of Civil War Days, maybe another one that may have given you some challenge, and figure out where it started, kind of the original kernel, and where it surprised you, where it made the turn, and kind of when you figured out what it was really about. Because the Civil War story, I feel like, is about it's about so many things.
I know, right?
And,
I know. That just kept unfolding. As I was working on it, I realized, oh, wow, and there's this layer and this layer.
Yes. I mean, that was really an origami project. I was like, oh, it's about this. No, it's really about this.
Right.
So where did that one start?
I think there was a woman I met briefly who was talking about her aunts one day. I was in the South, and she was talking about her aunts, and she said about one aunt that the woman had lived with her husband for many, many years without really much of a relationship at all, except publicly. And she said because the man had cheated on her, and she said back then there was no divorce, no forgiveness, and no divorce. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, there's a line. Mm-hmm. So that line, I just kept thinking, ah, and it seemed appropriate time-wise. I mean, because, 45 years ago, one did not get divorced as much as fast as they do now, and it would have been a little bit, for somebody like Fergie and his wife to actually openly divorce, it probably wouldn't have happened. So that's, I thought, okay, let's start with the concept of this. And then Fergie was just so real to me. And then I don't know where I got the idea of the duct tape, but once I did, I was just delighted. I just thought, this is just wonderful. They live with duct tape down their living room and their dining room. And then, of course, I realized, oh, wait a minute, they're going to have two TVs, of course. And it was just, it just developed as I just kept thinking and being in their house and watching them. And then, realizing that, of course, it actually is a real marriage in many ways.
Right.
I mean, it's not an ideal marriage, God knows. But they are married, with their anger. They are married to each other. And then Fergus, who I had him, dressing up as, the Scots person and Scotsman, and also the Civil War. I thought, okay, this is great. And then when I realized it wasn't until I had the daughter come home and say she was a dominatrix that I understood the connection. I thought, oh, this is perfect. They mm-hmm. both like to dress up. Mm-hmm. And that's what, but I didn't consciously do that. I realized it later. So interesting.
Isn't that great? I just think that's the best thing about writing.
Great. Exactly. Yeah. But you're exactly right. And I just thought, whoa, look at this. Wait a minute. This is perfect.
Yes.
So, yeah. And then I just had, fun with Teddy being called, named after the dog, and the grandson being named after the dog, because that would happen. Could happen.
In
a place like Crosby. Yeah.
I mean, it's just so wonderful when these stories take a turn that not only did the reader never see coming, but the writer never saw it coming. And
then you
realize something psychological has been unlocked that your conscious brain could have never done on its own.
I know. You're exactly right. And I'm always so surprised at how much my conscious brain is not working at the time that I'm writing out all these different things. And like I said, it really wasn't until afterwards that I realized, oh, look at that. I knew, some part of me knew what I was doing, or apparently. And but that, not my conscious part.
Right, right. And that kind of gets to my question about you. I mean, you've spent a lot of time in other occasions talking about the importance of truth, getting to the truth, and how you felt like not really writing the real truth prevented you from maybe being the, you know, once you figured out that you really had to be as emotionally honest about characters on the page as you possibly could be, that kind of ignited your career. And I'm always curious about how we know when we're, how we know we're not tricking ourselves anymore, how we know when we're being truthful. And maybe the key to that lies in this idea of the subconscious when it's doing the work.
You know, that's, I mean, that's, again, that's such a good question because, and I might have even said this to you before, but, you know, when Hemingway said all a writer has to do is get up and write the most truthful sentence he knows, for years and years and years I kept thinking, well, what is that? I mean, it seems so simple, but really when you think about it, what is a truthful sentence?
Yeah.
What is the most truthful sentence that you can write? And it's not easy to figure that out. And for years I just kept thinking, well, what is that? What is it? And so finally I think I finally just began to sense it as I was able to do it more. And I think you're right. It's not a conscious thing. And I was trying to come at it with a conscious mind. Okay, consciously, what is the most truthful thing? But then when you get rid of that and you just go inside somebody and just try and try and try to figure it out without your conscious mind totally at work, then I think, you know, something truthful happens. And then the conscious mind can look at it and realize, oh, okay, I think that might be it.
Right. And I wonder if that's what fiction gives you, the freedom to be able to do that. You know, once all of, I'm having this sort of exorcist sort of moment of something inhabiting you, but all of sort of inhabiting you. But that would give you a lot of freedom once you have her voice, her language, the way she sees things, her verbiage. It would maybe then free up your subconscious to be honest in a way that would be really hard if you were writing a memoir or something.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I've always said that I just, for me to write nonfiction is so difficult because there's nothing between me and the reader. It's just my voice. And I don't know really what that voice is, but I know my fiction writer's voice now, you know, finally, after many years. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's helpful for me to have the fictional characters to be able to be truthful inside of.
Right, right. My guest this morning is Elizabeth Strout. We are talking about Olive again, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I know at some point somebody had asked you about Olive's backstory, and you said, you know, I know it, but I'm not going to share it. And that reminded me of, I think it was Meryl Streep I heard years ago say something about, when I'm acting, I have to know a secret about the character that I will never reveal and that will never be revealed to the audience. And that's what informs her, and it's what makes her rich and
interesting.
Interesting. And I was wondering if that was sort of your approach with some of your characters, that you know things about them that we will never know, that makes them deeper, more textured, more interesting.
Right. And then I provide the reader only what I think the reader needs to know.
Yes. Kind of like poetry in that regard of the silence is sometimes the most important thing.
I think so, because, and also, you know, with, I've always thought to myself that a reader should be able to bring their own lives to a book. I mean, the book should be porous enough and open enough for their lives to enter it as well. You see what I mean?
Yes.
And that's why I think every book is different to every reader.
Yes.
So I will give them the information they need, but no more, and then they have more space or silence to enter into it themselves.
Which is probably why so many people come to you saying, I know Olive, I know this woman, or I am this woman.
Yeah.
You know, and
right, I know.
That's
amazing.
That must happen to you so often.
It has happened a lot, and it's been fascinating, really, really fascinating. The chord that she has struck with seemingly very different people.
Yeah. Some of that, I wonder if it's her style of mothering and how her particular way of mothering, I sense, informed an entire whole generation now of helicopter, lawnmower, snowplow, whatever yeah. the phrase is, parents. It's because that right. generation before us had mothers like Olive or you know, some
yeah,
variation
exactly.
of her.
You're exactly right. I mean, yes, there was a tremendous shift in my generation of how we mothered as opposed to how we were mothered. And it was across the board, it seems.
Yes.
Which is fascinating. Yeah, no, I mean, when I was a kid, you know, we were just sort of let out of the house to go play. And if we didn't show up for dinner, then they might be concerned. But otherwise, you know.
But maybe they wouldn't
we
have
were
been.
Just out there. Right. Yeah, I know, maybe they wouldn't have been. I mean, we were just out there playing around. I mean, everybody was.
Yeah.
And it was just a different kind of experience. And even now when I go to Maine, I realize, oh, I just don't see kids riding their bicycles around town like we used to or something, you know. It's interesting.
Well, and the story that appeared in The New Yorker this past summer, Motherless Child,
right.
I thought was a really interesting choice for that reason, and I don't know if you had any say over which story in the collection you wanted put in The New Yorker, but it's...
No, they did. It shows that themselves.
Okay. But it just shows such a universal experience. As you say, across the board, that dynamic really changed, even across cultures. I mean, I think even in Europe and Asia,
right.
things have
I
changed.
Think so. No, I think you're exactly right, actually. I think you're absolutely right, because I have had Italian readers... you know, respond even to that story. And you're right. It's there is something, you know, that's just changed about parenting.
Yeah. Yeah. Universal.
Yeah.
You've talked about your own mother as being a wonderful character sketcher back in your days, that you would sit in
yeah,
like grocery store parking
story.
Lots.
Right. Oh my God. She's such a story. She's even now a storyteller. Yeah.
I love it. I love that
yeah,
you'd sit in, like,
too.
Grocery store parking lots, and she'd be like, oh, that's a second wife, or oh, that's...
Oh, I know. And she still is capable of that. She's just fabulous that way. Honest to God, she's the funniest storyteller I think I've ever heard, because she has that very flat main affect, and so her voice level never really changes, but you just sort of hang on every word.
Love it.
Because she takes you someplace that, you know, at least I find her fascinating.
Do you kind of credit her with your writerly sensibility? Is that kind of where it came from?
I do. I really do, because of those early memories of her making up stories about the different people that she saw, and because she has an emotional understanding of people, an intuitive understanding of people, I think, that I got from her, I believe.
Yeah.
And she always encouraged me to write. So, yes, I really do think I'm a writer because of my mother.
I thought it's a great exercise to just sit in an airport or sit in a Starbucks and create backstories for the people who walk by. Like, yep, second
wife. Oh, it's just fascinating. It's just so fascinating. It's just fabulous. I mean, I think that's my idea of a really good time. But
yeah.
Just saying.
Is that a bit how you come up with these? You know, is it a whole cloth just sitting alone in your office, or is it really being out in the world and observing someone and then saying that would make a great story or that would
well,
be
well, you know, I right. I mean, I'm always watching people and I'm always listening to people, and I always have. But here's one example, because in the original Olive Kittredge book, there was a couple in that story called Starving. There's a young couple. And she's ill. She has anorexia in that story. But the couple that I used visually for that, I saw in a subway probably 6 years earlier. And I just saw this couple. They were adorable. She was sitting on his lap, and she had that same denim jacket with a fake fur that I had her in the story. And she was saying, "Stop sniffing me. I know you're sniffing me." And they were just adorable. And I sat across from them, you know, for, you know, 20 minutes on the subway, and then they got up and left. But I always kind of evidently remembered them, because then when Harmon is, you know, walking into the marina, this couple is sitting there, and she's sitting on his lap, and she says, "Stop sniffing me." And it was just from that. And then I had to make her, you know, ill for the story.
Right.
But the visual of that couple was absolutely from a memory that I had on the subway in New York.
That's fantastic.
Years earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in that way, you know, I realized my mind works. I had no idea I would remember them, but I did. So.
You know, and to that point, a lot of writers talk about carrying around notebooks and taking notes and recording dialogue. And other people
right.
I have heard say, you don't need to do that because the things that are important will come back
yeah.
to you in time.
Yeah.
And
right. That's how I am. That's how I am. I don't carry around a notebook anymore. I mean, once in a while I used to carry around a notebook just in case a scene came to me, not because I saw anything, but if I had a scene arise in me, I would
yeah.
think, oh, I should get that down. But I don't anymore. And I also, but in terms of recording what people say, it's like I'm with the former latter,
yeah.
half of the people that you said, you know, if it's good enough, it will stay with me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's not, it will go.
Right. How many versions of these stories, how many revisions do they typically go through?
You know, it depends on the story. I mean, some of these came out rather quickly. I mean, I think The Poet was done within a few months, which was amazing
wow.
for me. But the Suzanne Larkin story called Helped, that took me many, many revisions
mm-hmm.
Before I got that to a point where I felt okay about it. So it just depends. It's funny. I don't know. You know, Fergie's story came out pretty quickly, actually, once I figured out that duct tape.
It is funny what unlocks a story. Yeah.
Yeah, it is so interesting. And the Kaylee Callahan one took a little bit more work. You know, that's practically a novel in itself.
Yes, right.
That story.
Right.
But so... You know, I had to get my feet under me for that one.
It's interesting that The Poet was written, you know, contemporary. I mean, it was written so much earlier than it appears in the book. It's kind of, you know,
right.
longer in her evolution,
right.
in Olive's evolution.
Right, right. And that was interesting. And then I thought, okay, well, you know, obviously she's married Jack because, you know, he's dead by that story.
Right.
So then I thought, well, let's go back and get her married up.
Right. That goes back to my image of your office with things kind of scattered around, but you know where
yeah.
things go. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
a really,
exactly.
Really interesting way to work in that sort of tapestry, you know.
Right. And I do, you know, it's, yeah, I do sort of think of it as a bolt of material and I know where the stars are going to be on it or something.
Yeah.
you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
but. Oh. I don't know.
Well, we're drawing down on our time. Are there writerly words of wisdom and advice that sort of sustains you? I know that you worked and toiled for a very long time writing before publication, and I don't know if there are things you can share with listeners about perseverance or, you know, kind of what kept
you
going.
Yeah, you know, I think I would be the poster person for, you know, rejections because, you know, Raymond Carver said he kept writing long after it made sense to stop or something. And I did the math one time and I realized, oh my God, I'd gone so much longer than he had. So I can only say, you know, if you want this and if you really want and know that you can be a writer, just don't stop. Just don't stop. You will get there.
Yes. Yes. You know, it is so much perseverance. And it's so funny because I was talking to Anne
yeah.
Patchett with the last interview, and, you know, she had published very early on, and I don't know,
right.
17 or something in the Paris Review, and we, you know, you're just
right.
kind of trying to figure out what this crazy mix of
right.
perseverance, work, talent, all of that is.
And right.
I think it's perseverance.
Right.
I think
perseverance matters more than anything, frankly.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Yeah, it's much more than any sort of talent or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this was all worth waiting for. This was absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And we get to talk again. So we're gonna
I'm so glad.
Gonna meet in person.
Lovely.
Me too.
I really look forward to it. I know.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, and we are streaming live on the web at KUCI.org. Obviously, the show will join the other interviews up on the web and on that podcast. So again, we are on iTunes. We are under Writers on Writing. I am your host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Lisa Funderburg is a writer and editor and a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Pennsylvania. Her collection of oral histories, Black, White, Other, Biracial Americans Talk About Race and Identity, has become a core text in the study of American multiracial identity in college courses around the world. Her own latest book is Pig Candy, Taking My Father South, Taking My Father Home. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, National Geographic, Salon, and The Nation. And today we are talking about her anthology, of which she is an editor and contributor to the introduction, Apple Tree Writers on Their Parents. This is 25 essays plus Lisa's very compelling introduction of contemporary writers reflecting on their parents, their impact on them, good or bad, their similarities, their oppositions. At least a few of these writers have been guests on the show, Ann Patchett most recently, John Freeman a while back a couple of times. It is published by the University of Nebraska Press. It is out and available now, and it is really compelling. Lisa, welcome.
Hi, great to be with you.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. So Susan Strait was on the show a few weeks back with her memoir, In the Country of Women. I don't know if you've read that, but it was sort of a tome version of this idea, kind of exploring generations of family influence, you know, specifically female family influence. But it was so compelling that once I saw all these writers reflecting on their parents and their impact, I just really wanted to keep that conversation going. So this is great. So talk about what it was for you, like that, what kind of precipitated this project and got you thinking that this was a great idea to construct an anthology around?
So, of course, the title comes from the saying, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. But that's not news. You know, we all know this is true. It is a part of how we go through life, being reminded that we look like or act like a parent. And what was interesting to me was that sometimes when I was younger, that likeness just made me sort of run screaming to the therapist to have it excised. I was so busy with my own individuation processes, becoming my own person. I was so invested in that I really wanted to push away likenesses with my parents. And I had this incident a few years ago where this inherited trait came out unbidden, unexpected, and it was so peculiar to me that I was surprised. It made me think about what else is in there, and it also, my reaction to it was so different from how I'd reacted to such things when I was younger that it just raised a tremendous amount of curiosity, which is really what fuels my work.
Right, right. Do you want to talk about that incident? Is it the incident
Sure.
in the introduction?
It involves coffee.
Yeah.
So I was going to teach at the University of Pennsylvania one day and needed some caffeine before my three-hour time block and got a cup of coffee, downed half of it in the coffee shop, walked outside, and immediately threw the rest of the cup away. And there was something that was like a muscle memory in doing that that kind of surprised me. And I thought, that's funny. I'm following a rule I didn't know I followed. And what is that rule? That rule is don't drink on the street. And where did that come from? And it started this really kind of Proustian, you know, tumbling into exploring and thinking about the past. And I realized that behavior was really rooted in the experience of being a Black boy in the 1930s in the Jim Crow South, all of which are not me. Mm-hmm. But they were my father. And so I realized I'd inherited or absorbed this lesson from him, and it had never been actually explicit, as it is in many families. I mean, many families will say, you know, that's common, don't do that. But in this case, I had just sort of passively absorbed it. And as I thought about it, I remembered a time in the 1970s when I was a teenager walking down the street in Philadelphia, where I was from, not far from where I now teach, and my father pulling up alongside me in his car, rolling down his window, and I had a can of soda in my hand, and he said, "Should you be drinking like that on the street?" Mm-hmm. And that was a sort of unusual episode because my father was very strict in certain regards, and one of them was to always answer him promptly if he ever asked a question. And I didn't answer him because the question confounded me. And then, strangely, he backed off, which he never did, and said goodbye and drove away. And as I thought about it just a few years ago and reflected on these moments, all the life that I've lived in the intervening 30, 40 years informed my scrutiny of those moments. And for one thing, for the first time, I realized that my father may have backed down. And that sort of inverted gravity for me. Hmm. It was the only time in my childhood or my life with him, mm-hmm. I could ever remember having happened. And so my father had been dead some years when I got this cup of coffee. And it was fascinating to me that our relationship evolved even after he was gone. My understanding of him, my sense of him, our sort of relative positions in the constellation of our family shifted ever so slightly. Hmm. And then finally, another piece of that moment was that it was a deep comfort to me to have him visit me in this way, even though that small action was negligible. You know, it doesn't matter in my life whether I drink in public or not. I'm not at risk of being put on the chain gang or in some other ways humiliated for a purported misdeed just because of this racial configuration. But the trait, the value of the trait aside, it was just lovely to have him appear to me in a way that was a little surprising.
The greatest thing about that story, well, one of the many great things about that story is that
it, I did go on. I'm sorry.
No, it's wonderful. That's exactly what I wanted. But it shows both nature and nurture at the same time. Sort of this maybe inherited grief, you know, or inherited trauma that he carried with mm-hmm. him, but that he passively or maybe inadvertently passed on to you in that moment of stopping you on the street and saying, "What are you drinking on the street for?" Like it shows all of that in one very concise, simple act. And then, as you say, you come to understand it in different ways as it unfolds in your psychology over decades. Even after he's gone. And it's, you know, that's such a gift for writers, is to find one of those distilled moments that can easily stand in and demonstrate the complexity of the human relationship in all of its forms and over time and all of that. It's, I guess that's what makes us writers, right?
I think that our openness to those moments and our tendency to sometimes see life as a metaphor or to just look at experiences through a lens of their imagistic value, their representative value of larger ideas. You know, we spend so much time looking for metaphors and similes mm-hmm. that in some ways perhaps that lens is always active.
Right. So that was sort of the catalyst for this project. And then you had to go about the daunting task of finding the 25 people who would contribute to it. So talk a little bit about that, about choosing the writers, because there's such a depth and breadth here that I sort of suspect is calculatingly accidental, meaning that whenever you put 25 people together, you're going to get a broad range of experiences. But you also chose these people, it feels like, across ethnic and geographic lines so that you would get, well, U.S. geographic lines,
But I imagine you were looking for some broad experiences and choosing them, and I'm just curious about that process.
I love the idea of calculatedly accidental, which is really what I wanted. So my first piece of advice to people in terms of writing an anthology is don't know what you're getting into. I had never done an anthology before. I had no idea. My whole relationship to spreadsheets has been transformed to try and keep track of all of the moving parts of this. But in fact, it's been a tremendous joy and creative and intellectual challenge for some of the reasons that you mentioned. So I had this personal epiphany. It made me curious to hear what sense other people made of these moments. And I really had a kind of allergic reaction to over-sentimentalizing such things, which ends up in kind of a Hallmark card or, no disrespect intended, chicken soup kind of a presentation, which often in that sentimentalization ends up sort of pulling punches about the complexity of who we all are and also aiming for a tidy ending, a bow at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't feel like nonfiction to me. So that was my mission, was to basically create a super interesting conversation on the page, a prismatic meditation on this idea that, of course, we're all like our parents, but what does it mean when we discover that? What do we do with that information? How does it reshape our sense of the past or the future, ourselves, our relationships, our parents? It's really the basic stuff of life, but that's all we have. And why not have that considered and mulled over by people who are amazing stylists who have great integrity in their work? I didn't want anyone to phone this in. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I decided I would not go the reprint route. Although I'm sure there is beautiful writing out there from people about their parents, since all writers do have parents, I wanted the experience as an editor. I decided it would be more fun for me if this was new work, which also made it trickier because I had very little to offer in the way of remuneration to writers other than careful, close, and respectful attention, which is, in fact, what we all want as writers. Yeah. But I wanted to find people who were diverse in every possible way. So that had many tiers to it. The first filter was that they had to be great writers or great creative people. That was not negotiable. But then on top of that, I did want a racial and ethnic and gender and sexual orientation mix. I did want a mix of people who were raised with biological parents and people who were not. I did want geographic difference. I did want areas of specialty difference. So in this mix, I have, for example, a television writer in Shukri Tillman, a nurse in Sally Tisdale, a poet, more than one poet, but a poet, Donna Messini, a classics scholar and critic, Daniel Mendelsohn, a radio journalist, Karen Grigsby Bates. And my thought was, who would want to read an anthology that's all the same kind of clubby inside, you know, all one group of people?
Right.
It would be boring. And what would it add? So I did. I just cast my net wide and then on top of that looked for people who hadn't exhausted the topic already, who wrote in some way that I thought was interesting. Leland Chook is one of my contributors, and I came across an essay he wrote about a life-threatening illness he'd gone through, and there were some side mentions of his relationship with his mom that were so intriguing that I tracked him down. And he actually ended up writing mostly about his father, but I just thought the way he thought about it and the way he was able to render his parent dimensionally was a good indicator of how he'd handle the topic.
And a broad experience of good parenting and not so great parenting.
Oh,
and
yes. Right.
And what came
right.
What came out of that. Yeah.
Right. I really, this wasn't all about the bad things my parents did to me or how great my parents are. And I, in navigating topics, so I would have editorial discussions with each of the writers beforehand. And as I built the list, so I didn't start out with those 25 people. I would sort of get a yes and write down what they were going to write about. And sort of figure that into the calculation of, you know, was it positive? Was it about a mother or a father? What was the subject matter? I didn't want to have every essay about eating. I didn't want to have every essay about, you know, learning to drive. So I would try to sort of just keep balancing and broadening as I accumulated more writers along the way.
Right, right. I want to pull out one line that harkens back to your comment about trying to avoid this chicken soup sentimentality, and you pulled it out in the introduction, and John Freeman wrote about it, but it's this idea of love is in clarity, not in sentiment, and that really came through all of these being seen and being accepted for who, or your parents being seen and accepted for who they really were with all of their flaws and their faults and their mistakes, as opposed to being deified or put on a pedestal somehow, and integrating them as human beings rather than integrating them as parents almost, or, you know, accepting them as human beings rather than accepting them as parents. And I thought that was a really nice unifying principle to get around this idea of it becoming too sentimental. And, you know, kind of a theme that really ran underneath a lot of these essays. I don't know if you felt that as well, and that's how you pulled it out for the introduction as well.
Sure. And it's also it was my approach to editing pieces too. I was sort of the one person early warning system if things started to pull in too sentimental a direction. There were a few essays where they ended beautifully and then had one more paragraph. And I think so many of us do that as writers. We write and then we write some more. And often just sort of slicing off that last paragraph leaves us in such a richer, more resonant place than that sort of embedded, speaking of embedded notions, embedded storytelling sense we have from basically the earliest childhood books were read, where things have to end on some sort of clean closure, which again is not so much like life.
Right.
And it was important to me, I think one reason why none of the contributors are under 30 and possibly not even under 40. And again, that's because I think as younger adults, we're still shedding our childhood perspective, which is to not be that interested in who our parents are as people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're invested in who they are as our parents and with full love, but it's just not our job to be paying attention to that.
Good point.
And right. It's only as we're older and we start to go through some of the life paths that they have that we start to realize that they did this already and somehow did it while we weren't watching. You know, that allows us to see them with more dimension, which means that we can render them with more dimension on the page, which means that they're going to be more interesting.
Really
to
good
read
point.
About.
Yeah.
And also, I think if you give in to sentiment over clarity, in some ways, that's what I mean by pulling punches, that you might want to feel protective of a parent and not mention aspect and a less attractive aspect of their personality. If you are generally feeling positive towards them, And the inverse, if you're feeling negative towards them, you might not want to mention or be inclined to mention a positive part of their personality. But I think what that does is rob them of their wholeness. It doesn't afford them the dignity of their full personhood. And that is what I wanted the writers to engage with as much as they could.
So well put. So well put. I also want to talk about, you know, you can read this book as presented, and as a writer, you could also read it as just a master class on essay writing. And
nice.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I try to read with two hats on whenever I'm doing the show, because I have, you know, the how do we give advice to writers, and this is such a wonderful way to do it. I mean, you pose, you know, I assume kind of one question to 25 people, and you get 25 wonderful different pieces of work, but there are unifying themes. I mean, there are these writing the specific to make it universal, and these strong openings and the through lines, and these conclusions that just hit you in the gut. Anne Patchett's conclusion just hit me in the gut. And this idea that, you know, essays often circle back to the beginning, you know, at the end. You know, I was just wondering if you could make maybe a couple of comments on essay writing in general, when you're presented with a prompt, kind of ways that you universally think that these essays tie themselves together from a writing stylistic, you know, nuts and bolts style of kind of essay 101.
Well, what was interesting to me was how the different writers responded to the prompt, which was, you're right, very, very sort of simple and straightforward. It was, take a moment when you realize you've turned into one of your parents and then make meaning of it. And that was it. So it's in some ways a pretty broad topic. And it was interesting, for example, in the different formal approaches that some of the writers took. So many of them open with an anecdotal action scene and then reflect on that. That's their launch into it. And the chronology is fairly straightforward. Maybe they move from past to present. But usually the through line is pretty clear.
Right.
Chronologically.
Right.
Some people played with that. Lizzie Skernick, for example, has a really interesting structure. It's a braided essay in which she is first-person narrator speaking to two different people. And it goes back and forth. And one is her son, and then one is her mother. And it goes A, B, A, B, A, B. And it really builds beautifully towards its conclusion, in which you're seeing one of those threads is all about loss and one of those threads is all about sort of gaining.
Yes.
A love of language and a facility for language. And it's heartbreaking and also fantastic. And she is sort of, she's the one speaking to both of them, but she is this third character who plays a different role as the intermediary between the two.
Yes,
so that's
yeah.
a great one.
That was amazing. That was amazing.
Sorry?
I just want to stand out and say, yes, that essay it kind of broke the conventions of style in such beautiful and affecting and different ways. I wanted to highlight that one too.
And then another one that takes a different path structurally from the rest is Lolis Eli's piece, which is an epistolary essay. He's essentially writing a letter to his deceased father about the new son that he's had, and who the father would have been grandfather has never met because he's long gone. But and that structure of I want to tell you about your son is really a way of talking about what kind of father Lolis thought his own father was, and what mistakes had been made, and how to navigate moving forward in life.
Yes.
Then I think what would be useful to look at for writers in these is how small some of the moments are that the writers, I mean, they really are as small as the coffee cup. They are making, they're observing the everyday, the quotidian moments in life, but understanding how much of a base note lies under each one of them. So with Laura Miller's piece about her mother, Unlived Lives, the very act of her mother and grandfather coming into the kitchen of her apartment is revelatory. Or the idea of closing the curtains at night for Sally Tisdale in her essay speaks so much about what we let people see and don't let them see. So those are a couple of examples.
So beautiful. So beautiful. Oh, it kills me we're drawing down on our time, but it goes so fast, right?
It does go so fast.
But we can find you online. You have a wonderful website, which is your name, yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It
so,
is.
And I should say Lise is L-I-S-E, Funderburg, F-U-N-D-E-R-B-U-R-G. Is it .com?
Yes, okay. It is. It's lisafunderburg.com, and I appreciate Perfect. You spelling it as someone else who has a name that's probably misspelled
all the time. All the time. Yeah.
Yes.
I get it. But this is such a wonderful anthology. I really encourage people to check it out, and I congratulate you. This was such an important and fascinating project. It was really great.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
That was Lise Funderburg, the book, again, Apple Tree, Writers on Their Parents. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day.